Hi, I'm Yaakov Katz, and welcome to a new episode of the Jewish People Policy Institute's Inside Analysis of the State of Affairs in Israel and the Jewish World. On today's episode, we have quite the lineup. I start with an interview with Aviva Klumfass, one of the co-founders of Boundless, an organization that looks at reinventing Jewish and Israel education in the United States. Aviva is a well-known influencer, and you need to follow her Twitter feed and other social media platforms to see great stories about what's been happening in Israel since the attacks of October 7th. I then catch up with two of my JPPI colleagues, Gil Troy and Dana Luzon, for a talk about the stories that are coming out of this war and the contradictions between what seem to be the two interests, the toppling of Hamas and the return of the hostages. Aviva, it's a great pleasure to have you with us on the JPPI podcast. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for inviting me.
So you're in Israel right now. What is this, like your 10th trip since the beginning of the war, or you haven't left?
It's my third time in 3 months. So yeah, three times since the beginning of the war.
And I've been following you for a long time on Twitter, on social media. I know that a lot of people have, and a lot of people have actually been sending me some of the posts that you've been putting up on Twitter, X, whatever it's called these days. And it's really been, I would say, unique and special in a way. Very personal stories about people, about the victims, about the hostages. And it's like, it's personalizing them to a large extent, right? While we tend to think of 1,200 people killed, or now more, obviously, but on October 7th, or 240 people taken hostage, it's like these numbers that you can't really touch or understand, but you're making it easier for people to get what's going on. Talk to us about, where do you get these stories? Where do they come from? What made you do it?
Yeah, I would say it's really become a form of staying sane in an insane world. And that's saying a lot, because I'll be the first to tell you that social media isn't a healthy space, that it is a form of insanity in and of itself. But it's exactly as you said, is that we can't comprehend the magnitude of the loss. And we can't comprehend, we haven't had time to grieve for all that we've lost, because we're still in this war. We're still fighting to get hostages returned. But the magnitude of what 1,200 lives is, with family and with friends, and every one of them has a personal story. And I don't want that to go unspoken. And then on top of that, you had 240 hostages. You still have the official number, 136 at the moment. And then you have all the soldiers that have fallen, that have given their lives in this war. And there is this tremendous amount of grief and of trauma. And part of it is memorializing and honoring people. And it's also the simple fact that I will not stand by and be silent while the world dictates to us that we had it coming. I will not allow the duplicity of Me Too, unless you're a Jew. I will not allow the United Nations, where I used to work as a speechwriter for the Israeli delegation, to turn a blind eye for 15 years on all the crimes committed by Hamas and other terror groups in Gaza, and then turn around and point a finger at Israel now. And I will not allow a world to accuse us of genocide when it was 3,000 terrorists who flooded into Israel as part of their mission to wipe us out.
You know, part of it also, to me, in some of these stories that I've been looking at on your feed, and people you should all be following, Aviva, on X, but is the stories of courage and bravery, right? There's so many of those. I was thinking the other day, I don't know where this came from, but I was like, I gave a lecture in Jerusalem to a group, and I was like, when you look at the Tanakh, you look at like the Bible, and you pick out the book that really kind of is about courage. To some extent, I think it's like the book of Shoftim or the book of Judges. So all these stories of like Gidon, Shimshon, Devorah, all these amazing stories. It's almost like what happened on October 7th requires a whole new book to be written. And you've highlighted a lot of these stories of bravery, of soldiers or even citizens running in. Is there something that stands out in all of those huge mix of people and stories?
I would imagine that many people like me have countless times wondered what it would have been like if they had been in one of these sites on October 7th and how they would have responded and whether they would have survived. And I think in exploring these stories, it's part of trying to understand that psyche. And you're right, there's been tremendous sorrow, but there's also been tremendous acts of bravery. What probably stands out the most to me are these letters that soldiers keep, that their family find after they've passed, where they're even just a note that they find in the phone, which is a letter to their family and their friends beyond the grave. And in every one of them that I've seen, not just that I've shared, it's about the pride in the moment and the willingness and determination to fight for this country, to fight for their families, to fight for the values that they believe in. And it's incredibly touching. Most of them say they intentionally include that they don't want the government, if they become a hostage, they don't want the government to negotiate for them. They don't want a single Palestinian terrorist released on their behalf. So it's an amount of self that's being given to the state of Israel. And it actually even gives me chills now to think about it.
It gives me chills too, because I know some of these families whose kids wrote these letters, and it just blows my mind time and again. Who are these kids? Like, where do they come? There's something amazing and incredible in the youth that's currently fighting in Gaza and in the soldiers that we have in this country, that I think that sadly, to some extent, we needed this war to wake us up and realize what a unique group of people we have, what a unique army we have, what a unique society we have, because we lost that to a large extent in the run to the war, when we were just ripping and dividing and polarizing one another.
I call them the good old days of judicial reform, given everything going on now. But you're absolutely right, is that every generation thinks that the younger generation is a little bit weak, isn't it tough enough, didn't have it like they had it in their day. And this generation has proved its mettle unlike anything I've seen. When the invasion began and that commander said, "You are Dor HaNitzachon, you are the generation of victory," it is exactly what this generation is.
100%. So you mentioned before, Aviva, that you had worked as a speechwriter at the United Nations. You wrote a book about it. People, you should get your hands on it. The UN here, I mean, I don't even know where to begin to a large extent, right? On the one hand, we have a secretary general who from day one pretty much started to make comments like, this didn't happen in a vacuum. Wouldn't watch the video that the Israeli military had created, the 47-minute video of the atrocities of Hamas, until finally he did. Continues to make comments that just show a double standard, and I would even call it just some sort of anti-Semitic underpinning that he has, that Guterres has. The ICJ at The Hague, right? The ICJ being the court of the United Nations, and Israel being dragged in front of it by South Africa on charges of genocide. It's incredible what's going on. Not to mention the fact, and you said this also before, the duplicity of the Me Too groups, right? The fact that's the sexual abuse and the violence, and where are the feminists, right? Where are people calling out? It's like as if you're a Jewish woman, hey, rape is okay, don't worry about it. I mean, what do you say to all this, right? This is happening in America, in a country that's supposed to be our great ally, people who are supposed to be our great friends, a Western world that we're supposed to be part of here in the state of Israel.
Yeah, there's so much.
What do you do?
There's so much more bad to say about the United Nations. They don't recognize Hamas as a terrorist organization. They have passed resolutions where they won't name Hamas. I mean, the list of what they do and what they don't do goes on and on and on. And I have a mantra, which is, I will not accept this. We're going to protest. And this is not the way that the world is meant to be. And I will not allow the United Nations, which is, it's run like a democratic institution by nations that are not themselves democracies. And so this global institution has been hijacked by dictators and by tyrants that are trying to dictate to the rest of us what a civilized world is supposed to look like. And I don't accept it. I think that the United Nations is it's a hypocrisy. There's no doubt about that. But it's doing such a disservice. It's doing such a disservice to all the people in the world that want to live in freedom and human rights and democracy. And then you have these dictators at the United Nations directing what the world who the world is going to condemn, what the actions of the world are going to be. And it's absolutely not the way that things are supposed to be. And that's part of the protest. That's part of the protest of using my voice every single day to say, no, this is not right. And I will not let this stand. That will not be what it goes on the record, unchallenged.
Can that change, though? You know, I mean, you've worked in that place. You're out there pushing and trying to defend Israel on these different platforms and publicly. I'm sure there, you get a lot of flack, you know, and you people have their really nice responses to you. But is it a lost cause? You know, so I think that a lot of times people who are in the space of trying to fight for Israel, I don't like the word Hasbara, but in, you know, let's call them the Hasbara warriors to an extent, it's almost like you're trying to drain the ocean with a spoon, right? To a large extent, you know, it can't be won, maybe, the battle.
So first off, when it comes to social media, I think we have to remember that this is not reflective of reality, just from the simple truth that if you do public opinion polling of what people believe versus what you're going to see on social media, they are really two different realities. I receive an inordinate amount of hate. I have people that message me to apologize for the level of hate, and people write to me very nice comments, but I take the framing of the baseline assumption of I won't read the comments because there's so much hate, but also it's so much bot activity. The estimates are that about a quarter of the conversation as it relates to this war is inauthentic, so bots and avatars. And then I apply, this is not the case, but then I apply the lens that my assumption is that everybody that's writing to me is Hamas unless proven otherwise. And so I'm not willing to engage with either Hamas or a bot. So I just put my answers out there and I make my responses without getting involved in a tit for tat. I always say that social media, if I could equate it to something, it's like the Colosseum in ancient Rome, where it's basically you have an arena and then in the middle you have people that are bludgeoning each other and battling it out to the death. And then you have the lusty crowds that are surrounding them and cheering for the score. And while I do believe that it's important to engage, I don't want to engage in that type of forum. So I'm just on the steady beat of what I put out. In terms of the larger issue about the narrative war, Hasbara, or whatever you want to call it, I would say if there is one silver lining that I have seen in the last few months is that where we might have been leaving it to nonprofit organizations or government entities to fight this war, all of a sudden you're seeing a real interest from other sectors, and a lot of the tech and cyber organizations that are entering this space and saying, we will not accept this. And we're going to take the expertise that we've applied in other fields to come and fight this war. And I often say this, and I think it's the case, is that we've made more advancements in 3 months than we've made in probably a decade in fighting this war. And we're really just getting started.
You know, one of the other things, I guess your day job is you are one of the co-founders of Boundless, which is an organization together with JPPI fellow Rachel Fish, is meant to reimagine and kind of reinvigorate and design study of Israel in Israel studies and in Jewish institutions and across the United States. I'm curious what October 7th means for that, right? Because, you know, one of the big takeaways from my vantage point of being here in Israel is that we have what October 7th has shown us is there's a lot that we need to learn in Israel about the way we do security, but the explosion of anti-Semitism, the way that what happens in Israel leads automatically to protests in New York and Toronto and London and France and all over the world, show us that there's this connectivity that you can't run away from. And if you thought that you were some Jew who, I don't care about Israel, well, it's coming after you. Not Israel, but the anti-Semitism. So what does that mean for Boundless, for Jewish education, for Israel studies?
So you're right. I have the great joy and privilege of working with Dr. Rachel Fish. We co-founded this nonprofit called Boundless a little over 2.5 years ago. And we describe Boundless as a think action tank. The idea is to better understand the systemic challenges plaguing the ecosystem when it comes to both Israel and combating anti-Semitism or Jew hatred. And what we see is that there's these undercurrent issues that are plaguing every organization that's trying to engage in education or that's trying to engage in outreach and so communication. And we haven't properly studied them to understand the root cause. Social media is an excellent example of this. One of the first studies that we did when we when we founded Boundless before this war, was to really understand what is happening in terms of the conversation on social media. And what we found is that there's the existence of this pro-Israel, pro-Jewish echo chamber. Now, many of us instinctively understood that this was probably the case, but we're actually able to create a visual representation of what that looks like. And what it is it looks like a galaxy, like a photograph of the galaxy. And you see all these pinpoints, and everyone represents a conversation. And you see a lot of high activity in the center. And then off to the side, you see a small little dot with its own little engagement. And that's the pro-Israel Jewish echo chamber. And when you can visualize it like that, you can see we're not really a part of the mission, and we're mostly talking to one another. Once you understand that this is the case and you have this data and this proof, this evidence in hand, then you can really begin to have a conversation about what does it mean to break out of the echo chamber? What does it mean to really go and engage in this conversation beyond, let's say, just running campaigns? What is happening with the algorithms? What is happening with the policies of the platforms? What is happening in terms of potential legislation or regulation? What is happening in terms of intelligence agencies and their ability to monitor anti-Semitism and be able to forecast when online hate is going to turn to real world hate? Those are a lot of the questions that we've been working on, in addition to work that has to do with education and the problem as it stands right now, where we don't have enough qualified educators who feel confident and knowledgeable to teach about Israel and to combat anti-Semitism. And if that's the problem today, how much more so are we going to have a problem in the future? So we really need to address this pipeline problem. And understanding what's happening at the core is really what Boundless is about. So come October 7th, we turned the whole efforts of the organization onto addressing this war and supporting Jewish communities. And again, really divided into two areas, the education piece. So what are the needs, the resources that are required by Jewish organizations, predominantly in North America? And at the same time, what is happening in the overall narrative battle? What are the elements that we need to understand in terms of putting out content, understanding algorithmic manipulation, understanding what role inauthentic activity or foreign intervention is playing, so we can see it across the whole landscape of what's going on and understand where people need to fill in the gaps of the challenges.
Sounds like an army.
I often think of it as the drone wars. It does sound very Star Wars.
It's a huge battle.
But that's essentially what has to happen. And Boundless is not going to solve for all of this. But what we really believe is that you need to look and make sure that there is somebody in the space that will solve for all of this and make sure that one element is talking to the next. So that's really the role that we play.
Well, Aviv, I want to thank you so much for joining us at JPPI, and thank you so much for everything you do with really incredible storytelling and standing up for Israel. It's so important, as I think we all know, in these very difficult and challenging times. So please continue to do that, and thank you again for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, so that was a really great interview with Aviv. We heard from her about some of the stories that she's been telling throughout the war on her social media, different platforms, about the stories of courage and bravery and also tragedy, and really trying to personalize a lot of those stories. But we have, I think you'll probably both agree with me, Dana and Gil, that we have a bit of an issue right now with the war now 108 days into it. And we are basically, it seems to some extent, and there are some people who think that we're a bit of a standstill. There is a growing tension between the two main objectives of this war, the objective to eliminate Hamas and take out Hamas's leadership, but also the objective to get back the 136 hostages. And as we're recording this and talking, there are reports of renewed efforts and negotiations between Israel and Hamas, again, via the Qataris. Dana, you wrote a great piece about this for Walla, a very popular Hebrew website, news website here in Israel, about that tension and Netanyahu trying to play both sides of it. Why don't you explain what you were trying to say there?
Yeah, I think Netanyahu was taking a wrong decision when he was trying to present both things together, saying we need to kill Hamas and then we will bring back the hostages. And I think Netanyahu wasn't really thinking about the prospect theory about loss aversion by Kahneman and Tversky, because we know we hate to lose more than we love to gain. And after the 10th or the 7th of October, the Israel citizens are feeling that we are losing. And when we are still having more than 100 people hostages by Hamas, thinking about winning is not something we can really do. We are more afraid to lose them than we want to win. And when Netanyahu is saying, we need to kill Hamas and then bring the hostages, we are afraid to lose the hostages more than we want to win the war with Hamas. And if we are looking about what Gadi Eisenkot was saying last week when he was taking an interview in a very popular TV show, Uvda, with Ilana Dayan.
It's like the Israeli equivalent of 60 Minutes to a large extent.
Yeah. So Gadi Eisenkot was saying that if we need to put both things side by side, there is no way to put them together like Netanyahu is saying. He was saying if you need to decide whether to kill Hamas and win the war or to bring the hostages back, he will choose to bring the hostages back. And I think he was really feeling what the citizens of Israel are feeling. And I think Netanyahu is not feeling what we feel. He is not feeling the feeling of loss like we do.
Gil, I mean, you know, we've spoken about this, I think, you and I in the past also, and a lot of us. And it's no secret. I mean, there seemed to be from day one a clash of objectives in this war. And Donna was just talking about that, right? To say on the one hand, and I mean, to some extent also in the beginning, right, comparing Hamas to Amalek, we're going to eradicate them, we're going to destroy them. And now we're 108 days into this war and we're seeing that's not exactly so easy, right, to destroy a terrorist organization. It's not easy to get to their leadership. And it's not easy at all to get back the hostages. Military means is not what's bringing them home. The army would have you believe, though, and this is true, you know, we have no way of really judging, that the pressure is what's enabling a possible deal. So that's why the military pressure is needed. But you have this clash, right? And you look at kind of leadership. Would it have not been maybe more responsible and better? And by the way, Donna referred to Gadi Eisenkot's interview. What Gadi Eisenkot said, something that I've kind of felt for a while, is that we're not being told the full story, right? Tell us the truth. Tell us what is really possible. Tell us what we can really achieve. And instead we get what we call in Hebrew, sismaot, right? Slogans.
Think Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt during World War II. Think David Ben-Gurion during the 1948 war. Think Golda Meir, after Israel was reeling and surprised and failed in its conceptia in 1973, but nevertheless, each of them figured out how to speak to the people, how to reassure people. War is never easy until it's over, right? Everybody tells the story of World War II as if America won immediately. It took 4 years after Pearl Harbor, and the first 2 years, America was losing. And you think of Ben-Gurion, Churchill, Roosevelt, Golda Meir, and Bibi today. And the difference, the vacuum of leadership, the fact that when he speaks, no one listens anymore, the fact that he's even losing his base. And I know we're not supposed to be political. And, you know, there's been this weird thing of everybody being not political, but actually political. But he's been playing that game, too. And the fact that from October 7th on, he has not taken responsibility for the disaster when others have. He has not articulated a narrative, sung a song, given us a melody line that helps us understand how to get beyond. Early on in the war, while we were still trying to be apolitical, called for him to resign, not immediately, but to give a date and say, I'm gonna quit, because then every decision he made, every statement he made would not be seen through a political lens. And a number of my friends were furious with me. How dare you? You're being political. And many of them have come back to me and said, you know what? You were right. Because right now, whatever criticisms we had about Bibi Netanyahu before October 6th, many, many of us, even though we were critics, said when it comes to national security issues, he doesn't play with our kids' lives. And now more and more people are wondering whether he does. And that, especially when you have 136 hostages, especially when you have 1,200 dead from the start, especially when you have day by day that horror scroll of beautiful young lives, males and females, being destroyed, that is criminal.
Donna, one of the, I think, interesting parts or maybe aspects of this war also to me is that right? It's a war on two fronts. There's a war in Gaza, and then there's the war also in the north. In the north, my growing feeling is that so far we're losing, right? It's true that we could win. It's possible. But for the moment, we have ceded territory. We've basically created a security zone inside Israeli territory, when in the past we created security zones inside the other country, our enemy territory. We've evacuated 100,000 people, and there's no horizon yet of when those people would come back. So for the time being, it might be a temporary loss, but for the time being, we are losing the war to Hezbollah. And we're not yet winning the war with Hamas, right? We might win still there too, but we've yet to have what I would call a decisive victory. We yet to have a story that we can tell of where we've won. We don't have the hostages. We haven't eliminated Hamas leadership. In the Israeli media, though, you don't hear a lot of this, right? It's still very much the rah-rah of the army. And yet, as Gil just pointed out, we don't criticize the country and the government in a time of war. But shouldn't the media be maybe changing a bit of its approach? I mean, shouldn't it be a little more judgmental?
You know, when there is a new government that is being chosen, you know, this slogan, we are giving them 100 days. You know that?
Yeah, 100 days of grace.
Yes. Yeah. So I think what was going on, and I feel that something is beginning to change also in the media, slowly and carefully. But we gave them the 100 days to see how the war is going, how the government and the army is trying to deal with everything. And I feel that in this point that we are over the 100 days and we are still having the hostages in Hamas, and we don't have a feeling that the North is going in the right way, I feel that the quiet by the media and by the citizens is going to collapse slowly, but for sure. You see that also the families of the hostages are putting much more pressure, and they are trying, they are more, I think, extreme than they were at the beginning. And I think we see that there are now talks about we need new elections. And you saw that, and at Saturday, you saw again, people were standing and saying, we need to stop what's going on. People are going to the streets, not only the families of the hostages. I think we will see the things are starting to change. And I think that while you're in a war and you're giving them the 100 days, you are afraid to tell the truth. You are afraid to say, we are losing, this is not the right way, because you are afraid, you know, what are you going to say to your citizens, to the people, to the families who are losing their loved ones? But Gadi Eisenkot, for me, last week was a very special moment in this war. He opened the window, and I think it's not going to be closed anymore.
By the way, just one word about Gadi Eisenkot, who I have a lot of respect for, right? It was, you know, longtime general, IDF chief of staff. But in that episode of Uvda, he was given a bit of a pass. I mean, he was part of the conceptia. He was part of the conception as chief of staff.
He wasn't trying to deny that. He said, I don't have all the picture. I didn't have.
Right, I don't have all the picture. I mean, you had the picture back when you were chief of staff, and you were part of that push to try to contain Hamas and deal with it. And by the way, we all remember it was during his period as chief of staff that it was the stabbing intifada, right? And I'm not saying it was necessarily handled incorrectly, but he clashed at the time with Avigdor Lieberman, who was the defense minister, who was pushing for a more aggressive approach to Hamas, and he was against it, right? So
I'm not saying he doesn't have his side of in the fault of what is going on, but he was the one who stand and saying, like Gil was saying, he took responsibility by saying what he said.
And he said that we need leadership. And that leads me to my question to Gil. You wrote a piece the other day calling for Idan Amedi, the famous singer, songwriter, actor, who was injured quite seriously, but now he's out of risk, at least, but I think with some long-term damage from what I've heard, during his fighting in Gaza, he had enlisted on October 7th and served as a combat soldier and was hurt during an explosion, a tragic explosion inside Gaza, which was an accident. Why should he be our prime minister, Gil?
So it's a little embarrassing because I'm an academic. I'm supposed to be a serious person and I'm not supposed to write fan mail for celebs. And he's an international star, is known for his acting in Fauda and his amazing songs, which really speak to the soul of Israel. Even before the day that he was injured, he was posting on social media and he was saying things again and again about the need for unity. He wrote, and I want to quote it because it's important, "I join my brother reservists, my brother and sister reservists." And that's so important because there's a power from the reservists, just like there's a power from Gadi Eisenkot, who unfortunately lost both a son and a nephew in this war. "I join my brother and sister reservists in calling on the politicians, all the media outlets," and by the way, it's also a very important piece here, "and everyone, whoever doesn't have something good to say, simply shut your mouths." And then he fell in love. Here's a guy who could have been doing really holy work of going and singing from place to place and raising troop morale, which is really, really important because war is not just a game of body, but also a game of soul. He could have done that and he would have been a hero too. But he went and he was just a regular guy as a combat engineer, putting his body and his soul, like so many of our kids are and so many of us are, in front of the in front of the Jewish people, in front of Israel, and then unfortunately has absorbed this terrible blow. I understand he's out of the ICU, the intensive care unit, but is still in the hospital. And he is speaking before and after the kinds of pearls we need. And every war generates its heroes. It generates people, sometimes who simply showed valor on the battlefield, or simply spiritual heroism. And he's also shown an eloquence. And I think it's really important that we get voices like his who say enough, enough of the division. And I don't want black and red anymore. Because anytime the hostages use black and red, that goes back to crime minister and it's gonna resurrect Bibi's base. I want either blue and white or khaki, green. I want the green of the soldiers who understand that when you're fighting together, it doesn't matter if you're religious, non-religious, it doesn't matter if you're black or white, it doesn't matter if you're Ashkenazi or Sephardi, you are one. And that's the power that we need to win this war, and that's the power that we win, that we need to win the day after. And he is, at this point, the best symbol of that.
I think this is another answer for your question, Yaakov, when you were saying why the media isn't saying anything, why we don't hear more the voice that, frankly, for now, we're quite losing. I think this is another answer for what you asked. Like, don't, if you don't have something good to say, don't say it, because we are already in the feeling that we are losing things to October 7th. Saying more things is probably can crash our hearts now.
And we need morale. War is, it's important to talk about the spiritual dimensions. And Dan, I think you've done a beautiful job of that, talking about that in terms of the hostages and connecting the dots, right? The spiritual dimension of war, you know, war makes historians mystics, right? Because we'll call it morale, but it really is the kind of a spiritual power of saying that sense of one, that sense of having a focus, that sense of having a purpose. And unfortunately, our media has been much better over the years, like our politicians, at division. And we really need to figure out new structures to tell our stories, new structures to acknowledge disagreement, but not turn every disagreement into a nuclear battle. And that's the real challenge. And that's why I think people like Idan Amedi can be a voice. People like Miriam Peretz, who's been the mother of the nation, who's lost two sons before this war, who talks about reminding what unites us, not just always focusing on what divides us.
Right. No. But my only 100%, I totally agree. And he knows on his own flesh what the cost of this all is. But I think that what Gil and what I read in your piece, and putting aside Idan Amedi for a moment, who definitely a hero without question, But there is a hunger and a desire for new leadership, for fresh leadership, right? All of the people who are currently on the field, whether it's Bibi, whether it's Lapid or Gantz or Eisenkot, or whether it's Bennett, who's warming up on the sidelines, or even Yossi Cohen, the former head of the Mossad, these are all people who were there and all people who to some extent have failed us, right? What we do need, And I wish to an extent that maybe if it was possible for there to be new leadership that would come out of this great crisis that we face. At the moment, don't yet see it. Does Idan Amedi pick up what Gil wrote and say, "I'm now running forward with that"? I doubt it, but you never know. But I do think is that this, out of this rupture for Israel and this crisis, there is an opportunity for us to create some new leaders and a new generation, like the head of the Southern Command, the Pikud Darom, Yaron Finkelman, said at the beginning of the war, Atem Dora Nitzachon, you are the generation of victory. To the youth and to the soldiers who were going into Gaza when the ground offensive began at the end of October, there's an opportunity for that, I think, also to happen right now.
Thank you for joining us today. You can find all our episodes where you get your podcasts. Please share widely and give us a 5-star review. We will see you back here soon.